Good evening and welcome to Indie Radio News. It's a new weekly radio news program of The Independent, a free New York City-based newspaper and website with a monthly print of over 45,000 copies distributed all over the city. We cover social justice movements and the issues they are fighting for both here in New York and around the world. We are your hosts, Elia Grand and Lydia McMullen-Laird.
Beginning with national news. Dr. Blasey, who is accusing Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault, says she is willing to meet one-on-one with senators to tell her story. She made the offer in a letter to Chuck Grassley, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Dr. Blasey is set to testify on Thursday to the judiciary panel about her claim that Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her when they were teens in the early 1980s. Kavanaugh denies the accusation. In response to Blasey's letter, Grassley wrote that he is committed to giving her fair and respectful treatment. He did not, however, address her offer for one-on-one meetings. A few minutes after Blasey's letter was distributed to the media, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell accused Democrats of waging a smear campaign against Kavanaugh. Meanwhile, at least 600 women who graduated from Yale University between 1966 and 2018 have signed a letter in support of Deborah Ramirez, the second woman to come forward with allegations of sexual misconduct against Kavanaugh. In other news, Donald Trump is scheduled to meet with Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein on Thursday, the same day the Senate Judiciary Committee has scheduled a hearing with Judge Kavanaugh and Dr. Blasey. The Trump-Rosenstein meeting follows reports that the Assistant Attorney General secretly recorded Trump and invoked the Constitution to have cabinet members remove him from office. Congressional Republicans, Democrats, and some Trump aides have warned for months that Trump shouldn't fire Rosenstein, saying such a move could lead to impeachment proceedings if Democrats retake the House in the upcoming midterm elections. And at the UN General Assembly this week, Donald Trump is poised to redouble his commitment to America First. Trump will stress his dedication to the primacy of U.S. interests while competing with Western allies for an advantage on trade. He'll also shine a spotlight on the threat that he says Iran poses to the Middle East and beyond. Scores of world leaders, even those representing America's closest allies, are wary of Trump. Since his visit to the UN last year, he has jolted the global status quo by pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, the Paris Climate Accord, and by starting trade wars with China and the West. He addresses the General Assembly on Tuesday, and on Wednesday he will chair the Security Council for the first time. And on Saturday, the Trump administration proposed rules that could deny green cards to immigrants if they use Medicaid, food stamps, housing vouchers, and other forms of public assistance. Federal law already requires those seeking green cards to prove they will not be a burden on the government, but the new rules detail a broad range of programs that could disqualify them. The Department of Homeland Security said that being a current or past recipient of certain public benefits above certain thresholds would be considered a heavily weighted negative factor in granting green cards as well as temporary stays. In New York City, immigrants and advocates are gathering at Orchard and Delancey this evening to fight back against the new rule.
And in local news, Bronx Councilmember Richie Torres plans to introduce a bill to close the Kushner loophole. It fails to check up on landlords if they file false documents with the city. This follows an Associated Press report that Jared Kushner's family's real estate company filed dozens of false documents with the city. It falsely claimed it had no rent-regulated tenants in many of its buildings. That allowed it to avoid strict oversight of construction that critics say was used to drive out low-paying tenants. In other news, hundreds of women gathered on the steps of City Hall today to stand with Dr. Blasey, Deborah Ramirez, other survivors of sexual assault, to say, "We see you.
We believe you. We believe you. We believe you. We believe you."
My name is Cecile Noel, and I'm the commissioner for the Office to End Domestic and Gender-Based Violence, formerly known as the Mayor's Office to Combat Domestic Violence. I'm here today to really support survivors of sexual assault, to say that they need to be heard and be believed, that we believe them, that our office stands with them around both services and being sure that we as a city are looking to across city agencies to make sure that the services are available that they need.
Danielle Campamore, I'm 31, and I'm an editor with Romper and Bustle. I've shared my story of my second sexual assault numerous times because I leaned on the idea that I did everything I was supposed to do right. I'm tired of using that as a crutch. I'm tired of hearing about it. And Dr. Ford showed me that that's
Carmelin P. Malalas, and I'm the Commissioner Chair for the New York City Commission on Human Rights.
And you're one of the organizers of today's rally?
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit just how it came up and how you decided to...
Sure. We were listening to some of the rhetoric around the hearings, to people questioning why somebody who was sexually assaulted would take so long to come up, why somebody who's been sexually harassed would take so long to tell their stories. And we felt angry. We felt that people needed to understand the perspective of being a person in that position, being a victim, being a survivor, having to put their lives out for viewing, really trying to make sure that people understand and hear their stories so that people can make educated decisions that affect our nation's highest government. We know who people are, the people that are saying that they're defending our Constitution, the people that they're saying that they're defending all of the people in the United States. We need to know who people are.
We'll have more on the New York stands with survivors' rallies later in the broadcast. And last Thursday marked 1 year since Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico. An independent study from George Washington University recently estimated that nearly 3,000 Puerto Ricans were killed by the storm and its aftermath, almost the same number of people who died on 9/11. President Trump denounced the study as an attack on his administration instigated by the Democrats. In New York, hundreds gathered to mourn the victims of the storm and marched to Trump Tower to demand action.
My name is Lourdes Perez Medina. I'm with the Our Power PR NYC coalition. I work for UpRose. UpRose belongs to that coalition. I'm here today to commemorate the 1 year passing of Hurricane Maria and hitting Puerto Rico. I'm here to elevate those in Puerto Rico working for a just recovery in the front lines and really fighting against disaster capitalism.
My name is Brunilda Munoz, but I am a supporter of everything Puerto Rico. I just want my island back, you know. It's capitalism is killing us, you know. Everything is, they're just buying us out.
Today, we're joined by Melissa Mark-Viverito, former New York City Council Speaker and WBAI producer, and currently Vice President of Latino Victory, a progressive political organization increasing Latino representation in government. Hi, Melissa.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you for being on the show. So, Melissa, you are from Puerto Rico originally, and you still visit frequently. Can you describe for our listeners the situation in Puerto Rico today, 1 year after Hurricane Maria, just over 1 year after?
I mean, it continues to be a very emotional issue. We, you know, we still do have a crisis on the island. And I think that the lead up to the 1 year of Hurricane Maria on September 20th, all the activities that were organized was a way of really continuing to shine a light on the reality in Puerto Rico and the needs that currently exist. So there are still many people that have tarps as roofs on their homes, mold, uninhabitable conditions, people that have had to leave the island because they feel that there's no opportunity, or their house and their home have been devastated. This is a reality that still exists. 1 year is absolutely nowhere near completing the work that needs to be done after a catastrophe of this size. So, leading up to the 1 year, we, Power for Puerto Rico Coalition, of which I'm a part of, organized a week of action. We had a press conference with senators last Tuesday in Washington, D.C. We did a vigil in Washington, D.C. on the actual 1 year anniversary, September 20th. We did a vigil and a mass in New York City with a march to Trump Tower on September 20th. And we just did an activity on September 22nd near Mar-a-Lago in Florida, again, to demonstrate the power of our community, to say that the work has yet to be done, that we're recommitting ourselves to the work ahead, and that we have to present a legislative agenda in Congress that will ensure a just recovery for Puerto Rico.
So speaking of that legislative agenda, you are calling for a 9/11 style commission to investigate what happened after Hurricane Maria. Can you talk about what that would look like and why you're advocating for that?
So when we talk about, you know, right now, when you do the comparisons as to what the response has been to Puerto Rico after Maria versus, let's say, you know, Hurricane Katrina. After Hurricane Katrina, Republican Congress actually did convene a commission to kind of study what happened, to make sure that the appropriate resources were allocated one year after Maria, we still have yet to see a Congress come together and convene and call for any type of commission that will do any set of oversight hearings that will look at how did the response go so wrong, what are the needs that still exist, and how can Congress work towards allocating the appropriate resources. So Congresswoman Nidia Velasquez has introduced a bill that speaks to and calls for this commission to be convened and for hearings to happen. Unfortunately, because it is a Republican Congress, there's been absolutely no interest in getting anything done. And that is why the pressure needs to continue, why we need to flex our political muscle in the voting booth, why we need to make sure that other communities demonstrate solidarity with us, that we are united in our call for an appropriate and just recovery for Puerto Rico, and that we change the reality in Congress so that we can get in a more appropriate response. So the 9/11 style commission bill is Congresswoman Velasquez. That is one of the bills that we do support. And there's obviously a lot more work ahead.
So some people are saying this just recovery is not happening because of the colonial style relationship between the U.S. and Puerto Rico. What do people mean when they say that? And do you agree with that?
Look, the reality is that, yes, Puerto Rico is a colony of the United States. The issue of the status is unresolved. But the reality also is that we cannot pull back from the demand that there is a responsibility that the federal government has. There's a lot of great work that's happening in Puerto Rico, a lot of grassroots organizations that are doing a lot of creative, innovative work, and we got to continue to support that. But that doesn't take away from the fact that there is also a responsibility that the federal government has and that we're going to continue to push for that to happen. So although, yes, the issue of status is always hovering over us as a Puerto Rican people, there is an immediate need that exists that has to be addressed. And so we're not going to stop. We have to be relentless in our demand that a more appropriate response and a just response and a humane response is necessary. So that's the reality that we're living in right now. We have a fiscal crisis that exists in Puerto Rico, and the issue of the debt, which we believe needs to be resolved as well. That should be eliminated. There should be absolutely no money that is being allocated for the recovery of Puerto Rico. Should in any way go towards paying this debt, which has been incurred, which has been promoted through vulture, funds and through predatory lending practices that have really swooped in Puerto Rico. So we have to make sure there's a transparent process on how these billions of dollars are going to be dispersed. There has to be community input in that process and determining what the priorities are. This cannot be left to just the central government on the island making a decision as to how that money is going to be spent. There should be some sort of an authority that is semi-independent, that, like, similar to what happened after 9/11, similar to what happened after Katrina, that is set up to have some sort of say in terms of how these funds should be allocated. So there's a lot of work, and it's a very complicated reality that we're living right now. But that's why Powerful Puerto Rico as a coalition was formed, and that's part of the work that we have ahead of us.
And what about the Puerto Rican diaspora here in New York? What's the general sentiment, and what was the feeling on Thursday as you all gathered to mourn the victims of Hurricane Maria?
So we felt it was important right here. We have a federal government that has is criminally negligent when it comes to Puerto Rico. We have the occupant in the White House who's trying to say that these lives don't matter, or that these deaths didn't happen, or the numbers aren't real. So there's an attempt to kind of continue to dehumanize us, but to make us invisible. And so that is a very painful reality that these families who have lost loved ones, that we as a nation, right, as Puerto Rican people are living. So we wanted a moment of reflection, a moment to come together, to remember the lives lost, to recommit ourselves to the work ahead, and to say that we're here and we're not going anywhere and we're going to flex our political muscle and that we need a just recovery for Puerto Rico. So the mass in St. Bart's Church was beautiful. It really focused on the lives lost. It focused on the displaced families, which I believe, unfortunately, a lot of people have overlooked, and we need to pay attention that there are families here in New York, in Florida, and other states that have been displaced and that are climate refugees and that need support. So we wanted that moment to be about them, and then the call to action, right, marching to Trump Tower, of asking people to support the 9/11 Style Commission legislation that NIDIA has, and other work ahead of us. So we want to make sure that we do express our outrage, but that we also channel that outrage into action, and actionable items and actionable work. So that's what we wanted to do on that day. And it was a beautiful moment. It was something that I think we needed as a community, that opportunity to heal, to express our frustration, to cry, and then to recommit ourselves to the work ahead.
Thank you so much for joining us, Melissa. We'll have to leave it there for today. To check out more of our Puerto Rico coverage.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. To check out more of our Puerto Rico coverage for the Indy, you can go to independent.org. That's Indy with a Y. After the break, we'll be talking with CUNY Professor Linda Alcoff about the recent development in Brett Kavanaugh's nomination. Stay with us.
Welcome back to the second part of Indy Radio News. Thank you, Linda, for that first. Thank you, Lydia, for that first part on Puerto Rico. Now we're opening up with the Me Too movement. Today, people from all across the country left their workplaces and schools at 1 p.m. in solidarity with survivors of sexual assault, Christian Blasey Ford and Deborah Ramirez, who have recently come forward with sexual misconduct allegations against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. The organizers of this movement encourage people to dress in black and use the hashtag #BelieveSurvivors. To talk more about this movement and also about the nominations and sexual harassment, we have a special guest here in the studio, Linda Martin Alcoff. Thank you, Linda. Linda is a professor at CUNY and author of various publications, including Rape and Resistance, Singing in the Fire, Tales of Women in Philosophy, and she's co-edited with Feminism, Sexuality, and the Return of Religion. Linda, I would like to start talking about your recent publication in The Independent, an article that's titled Kavanaugh, Ford, and the Best Case Scenario for Accusers of Sexual Assault. In this article, you talk about a driving force behind the Me Too movement and also the parallel is that it's a risk of being that this reality is in risk of being twisted and distorted once it actually comes out in the world. Can you talk a little bit about how this has played out in the case of Christian Blasey Ford since she first came forward with her allegations about Brett Kavanaugh?
Well, what we're watching is, you know, I think the best case scenario of a survivor coming forward and making an accusation, because her accusation has been taken seriously. She has a team of excellent lawyers. The mainstream media has done investigation. They've even asked feminists to write op-ed pieces in major press around the country. And yet, within 36 hours, she has to leave her home because she's experiencing, you know, serious, credible death threats. So I think despite the fact that, you know, Blasey Ford and Kavanaugh are from kind of a rarefied class of people in the United States of America, these, you know, elite sort of private schools, the experience that she describes is one that I think is, you know, very common for a lot of people. And the behavior that he has been alleged to engage in is also very common. So people are watching to see what happens. And in the beginning, I think Trump tried to moderate his statements and not come off too negatively toward her and make distinctions between today's response and the response to Anita Hill. But right now it's beginning to look like 27 years ago without too much of a difference in the way that they're preemptively discrediting her, really without any evidence.
One of the things that today that was talked about in the protest in City Hall and the rally was the way people, well, not people, Kavanaugh's crew is questioning that how come she was silent for so many decades and sort of delegitimize her statement just because she didn't come up from the beginning. Can you talk a little bit about why people who are survivors of sexual aggression don't file more police reports and why there's a high percentage of people who come out many years later?
Yeah, it's the most underreported sort of crime in the United States. And I think what we have to realize about the silencing is that it's structurally caused. It's not just the psychological trauma that produces individuals' incapacity to report. There's a structural cause of the silencing because too many victims believe, because of their identity, their female identity, or some other form of identity, that they're not going to be believed, that they're not going to be seen as credible, and also that their suffering is not taken seriously yet in the society. Like, why can't you just get over it? And so then, to the extent they do have trauma for sometimes decades, as I did, that suffering is seen as self-caused. if too much of the general public sees this as not really a significant form of harm in a person's life, then how do you explain the fact that people have PTSD for so long? You have to explain it in some ways as self-caused, and nobody wants to have to deal with that. And it ties into long legacies of ideas about women's emotional incapacities and tendency toward hysteria and, you know, weakness in variety of ways. So there's a ready-made narrative framework here that's very long-lasting, has not been critiqued or unearthed enough, and that is ready to come into play when people like Orrin Hatch say she's mixed up.
Right. And it's interesting because we're seeing, especially today, we're seeing a lot of different movements that are coming out and supporting and asking for a testimony, and even this third possible person who might come out also accusing Kavanaugh. And I guess in general, I would like to know, I would like to ask about your reaction to the women who have been upset by the Christine Blasey Ford, how she's been treated by the Senate Republicans and by Trump, and who are now taking the streets. Sort of how do you evaluate that reaction?
Well, I think that this does go way beyond Kavanaugh's nomination and what happens with Blasey Ford. Trump's going to appoint another terribly conservative nominee. This is not going to end well.
That's not very hopeful.
Of the Supreme Court. Well, I think that the hope is that what we're really fighting over here, and what I think has galvanized the public imagination, is not just this single case, but the response to accusations in a more general way, and the right of speech, the right of survivors to tell their stories and to give their analysis of what happened to them, not just to tell the first person story, but their analysis of their perpetrator's culpability and the causes of what happened. So what we're really fighting over here is a much larger struggle over the terms of speech. Who can speak, what they may speak about, who's going to be given presumptive credibility over who. And I think the other thing is, the institutions. What Me Too has really shown in the last year is that this is never about individual jerks. They have an army of people who are enabling them, protecting them, absolving them.
Like a movement,
yes.
Some would say.
In every institution, the military, Hollywood, the church, and the media and so on and so on. This is really, we need to think about the institutional conditions that have silenced victims, right?
Right.
And that gets at women's ability to work in all kinds of environments in our society and to have a voice on their job.
Well, we have a few more minutes left, and I wanted to sort of ask about the latest updates of a third accuser. What do you make of this latest allegations from a second accuser, as well as accusations by Michael Avenatti that he has information about this third person?
Well, I think that it looks to have, presumptive credibility. You have accusers who do not know each other, who did not know each other prior to this. And I think with other cases where you have multiple accusers who do not know each other, I think that adds to their credibility. I think the best thing would be for an investigation to occur to try to get some further information about Kavanaugh's past. So I think there's presumptive credibility. I don't think that means that necessarily every single accuser's case is going to be credible, but there's so few that are engaging in actual manipulative behavior because the costs are so incredibly high,
right,
to come forward. So you have to really look at what the motivations are. Kavanaugh has huge amounts of motivations to lie. Blasey Ford has huge amounts of motivations to be silent, but she wasn't.
Right, and then that's sort of where everything comes in, that what are the motivations to come out? Because people are... There's no real benefits in coming out except for everything we're seeing that she's coming across. Well, thank you so much, Linda, for joining us today in studio. And I know this is a topic that we're going to be talking about sadly, for a while. And thank you for sharing your opinion. You can find her articles on independent.org. That's independent with a Y.
Thank you all for listening. You can catch us every Monday at 6 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 FM for all the latest from indie radio news. You can find this month's print edition of The Independent at our outdoor news boxes across the city and in local libraries, independent bookstores, and social movement centers. Follow all our coverage online at independent.org. That's indie with a Y, and via social media. To let us know what you think of today's show, send news tips, or find out how to subscribe to The Independent print edition, we can be reached at 212-904-1282 or contact at independent.org. Thank you so much to WBAI for hosting our show, and we'll see you next week.
Building Bridges, your community and labor report. From your workplace to your neighborhood, listen to the show that brings it all together. Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Bringing you news and analysis, local, national, and international. Monday nights, 7 p.m. We build bridges.
Come on, neighbors. Let's get wise.
So, the plaster is falling, the paint is peeling, the plumbing is leaking, the heat and hot water keep cutting off, the elevator keeps breaking down, and the landlord won't return your calls, but the rent keeps going up and up and up?
Find out what you can do about it. Tune in to Housing Notebook, Mondays at 8 p.m.
It only happens once a week. Monday evenings at midnight.
I wish they'd hurry up with that transmission. I want to go to bed. I suggest that you reach deep down inside yourself there and try and find something that'll keep you awake just a little while longer, because this transmission coming up may just rekindle your will to live.
Here on listener-sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM. The name of the show, Night Shift. Monday nights, midnight.
Midnight.
Midnight. Here on WBAI.
Hi, this is Nando Alberici of Con Sabor Latino here on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM. Please join us Sunday, November 18th at SOB's for WBAI's annual Salsa Explosion fundraiser. Performing in our benefit fundraiser are world-class musicians such as Johnny Dandy Rodriguez and his Dream Team, Bobby Allende and Ocho y Mas, Charanga Pacha, Anthony Carrillo, Amy Millan and Jambawa, Luisito Quintero, Robert Quintero, and Salsa Project. We will also present Con Sabor Latino Lifetime Achievement Awards to Martin Cohen,